are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we brew spicy new decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in competitive leagues and share our findings on the air. Coming up this week, our testing results with Stoneforge Mystic. After that, we're brewing new takes on old favorites: Red-Green Kiora, Niv-Mizzet Reborn, and old-school Grixis Control. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to week 19 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, coming to you live from the Twin Cities, and I am joined, as always, by the Faithless Brewing Brain Trust, Damon Alexander out in Seattle, and Dan Schriever. You know him as Cave Dan Online out in New Haven. Dan, are you back in town?
I am. I just got back a couple hours before recording this, actually. Spent the weekend out in Newport, Rhode Island. Gorgeous weather. Did a lot of coastal sightseeing and saw a polo match. I was living the gilded life experience.
And speaking of sightseeing, Damon, you were up in the Cascades for Labor Day weekend?
Yeah. I went to this cool spot that you go along the Pacific Crest Trail for a while, and then after around 10 miles, you wind up in the mountains. Completely stunning. My favorite mountain art looks just like it. And it was awesome. Had a great time. How was your Labor Day weekend, Dave?
It was pretty uneventful. Visited a buddy down in Northfield. For people who don't know, the Minnesota State Fair is a big to-do, so that finally ended, which was awesome. You guys went to the State Fair when you were young pups, yeah?
Oh, yeah, always.
Oh, yeah. Cheese curds, buddy. All day.
12 days before Labor Day, the Great Minnesota Get-Together.
Yeah, I have not gone since I was like 18, and I'm the Grinch who stole Christmas about this topic, so we won't... get too deep into it, but it sounds like you guys had a great Labor Days. And in addition to that, we were sort of gifted a brand new modern format. So we talked about it quite a bit last week. Stoneforge Mystic Unbanned, Hogak and Faithless Looting Banned. And there were all kind of questions about, you know, what the new modern format was going to be like. What decks are going to be good? Was Stoneforge Mystic going to be too powerful? We proposed some kind of loose shells. I think we're going to try some, as much as possible, sort of generic ports from Legacy, where I know you've had a lot of success playing Stoneblade, Damon. Do you want to talk about some of the decks that you played and kind of your first impressions of the sort of the new Stoneforge-centric modern format?
Yeah, so first off, I don't think there's like a completely like clean port of Legacy Stoneblade into modern. You're just like missing some of the critical cards that kind of really fill out that deck. Namely, True Name Nemesis being such a good equipment bearer is an important one you're missing. But yeah, so I started off with the 5-0 list by Doomswitch. Doomswitch and McWindsauce seem to be like the kind of two blue-white hustlers on MTGO. Their lists are always good starting spots. This list had 4 Snapcaster, 4 Stoneforge, 1 Click as the creatures, 3 Teferi Time Raveler, the 3 CMC one, 3 Jace, 1 Gideon Jura. I actually still don't understand why that card is there, to be honest. And then it had 3 Cryptics, 2 Forces, and then a bunch of Paths and some counterspells. And it had 3 equipment, Sword of Feast and Famine, Sword of Fire and Ice, and Batterskull, and then kind of the classic blue-white mana base. The deck felt good. I went 3-2. The losses all felt close, except for against Grixis Control against this streamer, Everos. If you guys are familiar with that player.
Familiar with the name. I cannot put an actual name to Everos. Yeah, they're fairly well known.
Yeah. I realized after the match, I was like, oh, they're on Twitch. Interesting. If I had stream sniped, I would have had a better chance of winning, maybe. But instead, I just got crushed. It was one of those games where he plays Snapcaster. I'm like, haha, I'm going to Snapcast my Spell Snare. And he's like, in response, Snapcast my Spell Snare. And I was like, oh man, just one of those games. And then in the second game, he got out like a turn 2, a Young Pyromancer, and he got 2 tokens out of it before I got rid of it. And those 2 tokens just kept crunching through every single Planeswalker I played. He had a cool list with Kess, so Crix's Control. I lost a close 3-game series to Jund. They just had a really good draw game 3, and I had drew like too many lands the last couple turns. I played against Blue Black Mill. It turns out Teferi Time Raveler just completely messes up Shelduck Isle. Every game my opponent would tap their Shelduck Isle in a blue and I'd be like, resolves, and then they would look and it would pause and then they would just kind of sit there tapped on the stack and then nothing would happen.
I'm fighting the urge to go on a rant about Teferi Time Raveler here.
Yeah, well, the secret is to just play him, Dan. Just play decks with Teferi.
It's so tempting to go on a rant. I know that if I complain about the static ability, some portion of the internet will be like, oh, what a bunch of noobs. Get over it. Fine. I'll try to get over it. I'm not there yet. I'm working my way through the feelings.
I think the correct way to counter-flame the flamers is to call them Yu-Gi-Oh! Players or something. I actually don't know what that means, but that's what I've seen bandied about.
I'm going to keep that one in my back pocket.
But yes, Dan, I agree. That card is absolutely absurd. I don't understand why that card was designed the way it was. All the new Planeswalkers.
There were so many variants on that static they could have printed, like a Thalia tax on the opponent, or they just can only play during their own turn or something. But just like the way that it randomly hoses the entire functionality of cards like Shelduck Isle, or Bring to Light, or a Dreadhorde Arcanist.
Or Suspend.
It's really infuriating.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to take a breath. Please continue.
There's a new 3MC Planeswalker that starts off with 4 loyalty and ticks up to 6. That's cool. 3CMC Planeswalkers shouldn't have so much loyalty to start with, is my opinion. That's my little rant.
Oh, you mean the one that was just previewed today from Throne of Eldraine?
Yep.
Oh, I have not seen this card.
It makes food tokens, and unless those, you know, make you like lose a life every upkeep, which I doubt they do, the card looks pretty good.
Man, the art of this set looks so sick.
There's one card that got printed that I don't even understand what the card is, to be honest. Like, it doesn't look like a Magic card anymore.
Yeah.
There's, like, a sorcery in the bottom left corner, and what is that? Why is there a sorcery in the bottom left corner? What does that mean?
I don't know. There's two of them that have been spoiled now.
That's an alternate frame. That's kind of, like, the masterpiece frame that will be available in some printings of the card. That's all I got for you. The regular versions of the card will look slightly less weird.
But it's, like, a creature with a sorcery.
Is that like a flashback thing?
Is like a creature that can also let you cast that sorcery?
By the time people listen to this episode, all will be clear, I'm sure.
Right.
We're talking on a Tuesday where literally this has just been cryptically spoiled for us on Twitter.
Our wild speculation about what food tokens may do will seem comically outdated.
We're going to seem like morons. All right. Anyway, okay, so back to this blue-white deck. So Jund lost a close 3, Grixis Control. It felt like it was winnable, but they just didn't go well. Blue-Black Mill was an interesting close series, but Teferi just messed up Shelduck. Teferi is like interesting to have in your deck just because it will randomly win you lots of games. Against Eldrazi Stompy, it turns out that Stoneforge Mystic in all the leagues I played was great. Great card. Was never bad. Was always happy to see it. Batterskull against Eldrazi Stompy, they just had a lot of trouble dealing with it. The Germ would die, and then I would just bounce a Batterskull and replay it. Some of the games went kind of long, and I could just do it all in one turn. 4-4 Lifelinker is just pretty good at what Eldrazi Stompy is bringing to the table. Even All Is Dust like randomly doesn't completely screw it up. It just kind of screws it up. In the last round, I played against White-Black Stoneblade, the Orzhov version. I managed to win in a 3-game series. I felt a little bit better having kind of the counterspell package versus the discard package. So this is one thing I want to talk about, is that this blue-white deck features a couple Supreme Verdicts in the sideboard. And I feel like Supreme Verdict is in a pretty good spot in Modern right now. The next deck I went to after this did not feature Supreme Verdict, and every single match I was like, man, I wish I had a couple Supreme Verdicts in here.
So that's interesting. So that was a white-blue list, and the next list you played was sort of a Jeskai Tempo Blade, or Jeskai Blade. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think it was from the SCG class. I lost track of all the tournaments. It was one of the lists, the Jeskai Blade list, that made top 8 of one of the big tournaments. I feel like I'm not doing the pilot justice by just completely forgetting who it was.
Let's just call it a top Jeskai Blade deck. We don't know what it was a top of.
Exactly. Yeah, so this deck featured a lot more creatures, featuring 3 Giver of Runes, 4 Snap, 4 Stoneforge, 2 Geist of St. Traft, 3 Spellqueller. Supposed to be 4 Spellqueller, but I misclicked on Mana Traders, and so I just subbed in a Vendilion Click, so I didn't feel like having to borrow cards again. So 3 Spellqueller and a Vendilion Click. 2 Restos, 2 Teferi, Time Raveler, 4 Bolt, 4 Helix, 2 Op, 2 Path, 2 Spell Pierce, Sword of Feast and Famine, and a Batterskull. 23 lands, which I think is actually just not enough in this deck. That was like the first thing that happened in my first game. I was like low on mana every single game, and I looked at the deck and I was like, 23 lands? Because between the Geist of St. Traft, Spell Quellers, Vendilion Clicks, Restos, Teferis, these are all cards that cost 3 or more mana. Snapcaster Mage secretly costs 3 or 4 mana. I had games against Burn where I had 3 mana out and a Snapcaster with the Lightning Helix in my graveyard, and I was just looking at the Snapcaster and the Lightning Helix. Couldn't make that work out.
So how much mana would you assess Stoneforge Mystic as costing? Obviously, it costs 2 to cast, but when you're thinking of how much mana does the deck need, do you think of it as a 2-drop or something more mana-hungry?
Stoneforge Mystic is such a weird card because it kind of has 2 modes. One is, like, it can be a super lean card if you need it to be, where it costs 2, and then it'll put into play Batterskull whenever you have the time to do so. And so, for example, in Legacy, you'll have hands where you have like a bunch of spell pierces and some forces, and you're up against Reanimator, and you squeeze in a Stoneforge Mystic, and it just gets a Batterskull, and they don't feature any removal or interaction besides discard. And so then the Batterskull sneaks in and then closes the game out. But then there's the mode that involves like either Jit or rebuying Batterskull, and these just become super mana intensive super fast. One of the best ways to use a sort of Feast and Famine is to catch your opponent by surprise with it, where you play it and equip it in one turn. Or if it's not by surprise, at least just all in one go. And this takes at least 4 mana. 5 if you are going to equip it to the Stoneforge itself. 4 if you can use a Stoneforge to cheat it in for cheaper. And then the Batterskull rebuy loop with the Stoneforge out takes 5 mana. If the Stoneforge Mystic dies, to rebuy the Batterskull and replay it costs 8 mana, which is just an eternity unless you have 8 mana to do in one turn.
So would it be fair to say that all of these lines of play that you're describing, they want to hit land drops continuously? No matter what you're doing with Stoneforge, you don't want to stall out on lands.
I think that you can play a much leaner deck. In Legacy, for example, there's like these Delver Blade decks with Delvers and Dazes, and they can afford to be lower on the curve, but I think that the way these modern decks are built, I'm not sure about that. Certainly, I haven't seen any list featuring Delver. That would be an interesting way to go. It feels like this deck wants to get to... I mean, it's playing Celestial Colonnade. That card needs to have like a lot of lands out to begin with. Also, furthermore, the list is a 3-color deck with some pretty heavy pip requirements. More lands just helps you mitigate color screw also.
Yeah, and typically when we see 23 lands with these kind of mana costs, we see a lot of cantrips. They only play 2 opt, so I do agree with Damon that there's some minor misbuilding happening maybe with this list that could be rectified if we wanted to run it back through a league. We would recommend some minor changes at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say for sure, but I mean, the pilot obviously had a good showing with it. So I don't want to read too much into how it went for me.
So other than the mana issues, what were your sort of impressions? Was the red kind of worth the... Was the juice worth the squeeze with adding, you know, Lightning Bolt and Lightning Helix? That's kind of the only red cards in the main deck.
The league I played, for whatever reason, I matched against Boros Burn, Red Prowess, Humans, Dredge, and Bant Spirits. So 4 of these feature just a ton of creatures, and so having a bunch of bolts is super good, and Lightning Helix is. So at least in this league, that felt like a great place to be. Obviously, if I was up against a bunch of like Tron or Titan Shift, it would be a little bit less clear. But it definitely felt like Jeskai was a reasonable place to be. The cards I was less sure about were, I mean, maybe it was just the matchup pairings, but Geist of St. Traft, I sat it out every single game. This deck features enough creatures that I didn't really feel like I needed to have like the hexproof reliability to put equipment onto it. And all these opposing decks, they're faster than this deck is, so they don't really care about Geist. Giver of Runes was interesting. I think I like Giver of Runes, but I'm not sure about that one. Resto just seemed a little bit clunky, and I was not a fan of it. But I did like the equipment package. The blue-white deck, I felt like 3 equipment was just too many. There were games where I would draw all 3 equipment, and they would just sit in my hand, and I would wonder like why I don't have any creatures in my hand. Well, it's because I drew all 3 equipment. It seems like the consensus is being that for most decks, sort of Feast and Famine is the way to go, especially with the blue shells, because it lets you maybe like play a Planeswalker, and then attack, and then untap and have all your interaction up. Sort of Fire and Ice, while it's good, feels like it's a kind of more of a sideboard card, or just maybe not even in the 75 at all. What do you guys think about that part?
Yeah, I was always curious, you know, in Legacy, there's two equipment typically, right? It's the Batterskull and obviously Umezawa's Jitte's Band in Modern. It felt like maybe you need 3 because you could easily start drawing Stoneforge and miss, but it feels like maybe 2 is the right number just because it is so clunky and you always want to make sure. I mean, equipment without a creature is a totally dead draw.
Yeah, I mean, the way it turns out is that if you wind up having like a Batterskull and a sort of Feast and Famine in your hand and you draw a Stoneforge Mystic, it's annoying because you don't get to draw a card part of Stoneforge Mystic, but at the very least, you're like, this card makes my Batterskull good, and you're actually kind of happy to see it, even if it's not like a, you go up a card.
Right. Yeah, as for the swords, I saw Ari Lax made a very interesting point I'm not sure I 100% agree with, but he thought that Sword of Fire and Ice is actually quite bad, and that in Legacy, it has all these hidden values where it makes your creature unblockable by...
True name
Nemesis. The two damage is relevant because there's so many smaller creatures in Legacy. He pointed to Delver of Secrets being an example. And Sword of Feast and Famine is by far the best sword in Modern. The Hive Mind is busy working its way through all the various sword permutations. And obviously the colors of your opponent's deck can turn your sword into a sort of an unblockable creature depending on the colors, so all that matters, but it was an interesting observation. He thought that Sword of Fire and Ice was sort of a card from a different time in Magic's history.
I believe he said, if you're going to play a sword, play one that was printed in the last 10 years.
But I'm not sure about that. Creatures have been kind of power creeping, so planeswalkers, you know, nobody plays 4 mana Elspeth anymore. But equipment somehow hit their peak with Jit and Batterskull. There's been no equipment even close to those cards.
Yeah. The awesome power of Viridian Longbow has not been matched. We continue to see that card even in some modern lists this weekend.
Yeah.
So I played it's functionally white-green. He lists it as Bant because he has two blue cards in the 75. But Nick Shirillo, who is Bob and Cheese on Twitter, posted a list. It's basically a Devoted Druid Vizier of Remedies deck with 4 Stoneforge Mystic, and then his equipment package was Sword of Light and Shadow, Batterskull, and a Viridian Longbow.
There it is.
Then he had a bunch of other like spicy one-offs because he does have Ella Domri's Call. So he has Ranger Captain of Eos, 1 Eternal Witness, 1 Deputy of Detention, and 1 Shalai, Voice of Plenty. And then he has the normal, so the 4 Ella Domri's Call, the 4 Finale of Detention, and then he's playing 4 Giver of Ruins to sort of protect his combo or protect Stoneforge Mystic. So this is sort of what we were talking about last week. If you didn't want to play sort of a value Stoneforge list, you could kind of just jam the package into a combo list and sort of try to overload removal, which is something that generically Vizier Remedy Devoted Druid lists try to do anyway. And it felt really powerful. The decks that I played that were interactive, which were specifically like other Stoneforge lists, they really couldn't keep up with all the angles. The white-blue Stoneforge list only plays 4 path in the main board, I think. Maybe some people are playing Oust. I'm not 100% sure. But you just have a lot of ways to just overload the removal. If you open on Giver and they don't have a path, all of a sudden you can really impact the board, and people aren't playing Wrasse in their main deck because they're playing to the board with Stoneforge. So the deck felt great. The one match that I lost was to Storm, which turn 3'd me both times, including a awesome Ella Domri's Call at the end of their turn 2. To get Eidolon, played Eidolon on my turn 3, and they had their mana reduction guy already in play, and they destroyed it for no mana with a certain Phyrexian spell. That was just a real big energy play, and then they, of course, killed me the next turn, so...
You just say that was a real big energy play?
Big energy play, man!
Oh, wow.
It was a mood.
Wait, which spell killed you? You said Phyrexian mana, but I was thinking Force of Vigor.
No, Dismember...
Oh.
It doesn't cost any mana if you're willing to pay the 4 life if you have a mana reduction guy in play.
Got it.
This is the Eidolon of Rhetoric that Dave is referring to. This is the one that makes each player only play 1 spell a turn.
Which told me he did not need his draw. He knew for sure he could go off. Like, he didn't even wait till his next turn to do it. So I was just like, all right, tip of the cap to the nut draw from Storm. But yeah, so this list felt really powerful. He even had a red splash to play Goblin Cratermaker and Magus of the Moon in the sideboard. I'm not sure if that's right, but the cost is pretty low. I think he's just playing 1 Stomping Ground and 1 Breeding Pool. Those are the only lands that can sort of cast these red and blue sideboard cards. But there's just so little interaction. It's so difficult to deal with a Boral on turn 2. There's very few cards in this deck that interact with it. And yeah, you have lots of ways to search up your Gaddock Teague or your Eidolon of Rhetoric. But if they, you know, get rid of it with various cards that they play after sideboard, you really don't have a chance. But yeah, the list felt great. I mean, you really are attacking from a lot of angles, and as long as your sort of linear plan is a little faster than theirs, this is a very effective deck.
Yeah, I mean, also, you should be about as fast as Storm, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, there you go. You should have won. I mean, what happened?
Yeah, come on, Dave.
I mean, he's casting free his members. That doesn't seem fair. I don't have any free spells in this deck.
You're supposed to bring in your Veil of Summers against Blue Red Storm, right?
Exactly.
So talk to me about the equipment package in here and how you actually used it. I see that the sword of choice is the white-black sword, Light and Shadow. And there's also the Viridian Longbow and the Better Skull.
Yeah, so the equipment package they played was a sort of Light and Shadow instead of the other swords that we're discussing. And I think that's pretty relevant because one of the ways we would typically attack this deck is just overload it with removal. Each of the individual pieces are pretty weak. You know, once you kill their giver, all they're playing is a bunch of, you know, 2-1s and 0-2s. And by themselves, they don't really affect the board. So if you're playing Jund or whatever, and you're Lightning Bolting and Terminating creatures, it's really easy to kind of just run them out of one half of the combo and then, you know, you just beat them down. But sort of Light and Shadow, once it connects, lets you find the missing piece. So it sort of combines with Finale of Devastation to turn your graveyard into a resource. The Viridian Longbow, I think, is an infinite combo piece when you have Vizier of Remedies and Devoted Druid out. It sort of turns the Stoneforge Mystic into a tutor for your kill condition. That never really came up for me. It would be curious to talk to Bob and Cheese on Twitter to see how often that came up. Most of the time, even when you have infinite mana, you can just Finale of Devastation, which I did for infinite creature and kill that way. But I mean, maybe it is useful to just to have that fourth way to go off. It never hurts to have another infinite combo in your deck, especially when the opportunity cost is so low, just to have one longbow in there.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you four extra sources of... This is fundamentally an A plus B plus C combo, and so every redundancy on the C part helps.
Five extra sources.
Yeah, so I think that's actually really good design with Stoneforge Mystic. How often was the Batterskull relevant?
You know, whenever I played Stoneforge Mystic on turn two, that's what I would typically fetch up. So it was relevant a lot because it would force them to use early removal on the Stoneforge. So if I was holding the combo in my hand, if I had a Vizier and a Devoted Druid or one of the pieces and a fetch piece, I'd normally play out the Stoneforge Mystic proactively to fetch the Batterskull. They'd have to deal with it, which they typically, you know, people are keeping one removal spell opening hands. And then the next turn, you're sort of deploying your Devoted Druid. If they don't have another removal spell, you can, you know, go infinite the next turn. It was quite effective in the sense of Stoneforge Mystic is just another Lightning Rod creature. And there's only so many removal spells that they're keeping in their opening hand.
And so, like, even in game two scenarios, when they know you're on this combo deck, you would still lead off on Stoneforge Mystic and fetch Batterskull?
Yes. Especially if I had Giver, you have a chance to just win the game with Batterskull. And against other Stoneforge Mystic decks, it felt better than Sword of Light and Shadow because Path neutralizes the sword. And one damage from the Viridian Longbow doesn't seem like it does enough to, like, combat their Planeswalker. So Batterskull's maybe just the best of three not-so-great choices against sort of like white-blue Stoneforge Mystic decks.
Worth noting that Viridian Longbow was the absolute best card in Mirrodin Block for draft.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important to mention. I should have told that to a bunch of people when they were dying.
I'm just saying, like, if I were presented with a pack of cards in cube and there was a Longbow and, like, a Sword of Light and Shadow, I'm not sure what I would take. Longbow is the nuts. It is the stone cold nuts. And it took several months for people to realize that back in the day. We were all busy drafting Bone Splitters and Full Shock Battle Gear and stuff. Anyway, that was a moment in time. I don't know if you guys played much of that. Longbow was a killer card.
I remember, yeah, that was a sleeper card that nobody realized was good for a while, and then all of a sudden it became a super high draft pick.
But I guess my generic observation is, playing against Stoneforge, and I've, over the many leagues, I've played three leagues, I think, with a bunch of different lists. I think I played 9 Stoneforge lists, or maybe 10.
Played against or played with?
Played against. So, yeah, 66% of the games I've played have been against decks that have, I guess that I don't know that they all have 4 Stoneforge, but they do. This is the kind of deck that feels great against other Stoneforge lists, because you have this combo baked in. It just feels like almost a mirror breaker. I think the other way to try to break the mirror is to play, you know, red, so you've got a lot more removal for their turn to Stoneforge. But I really like the idea, even last week when we were talking about, you know, maybe switching it into a combo list instead of a value list. And in general, I think Modern has been a format where having a combo finish instead of a value sort of finish, if you will, has been the better way to go. And that was borne out by how I felt. How did you feel, Damon? Did you feel like just sort of a value Stoneforge list felt great, or just Stoneforge felt great and we're still trying to find the next 54 cards to go around the package?
Yeah, I mean, the Jeskai list in particular, whenever I didn't have Stoneforge, felt like a bunch of Jeskai cards that were fine, but not anything like super powerful compared to, you know, like the Banned Spirits player. In one of the games, he put 18 power to play on turn 4. Turn 1 Vial, turn 2 Supreme Phantom plus Mausoleum Wanderer, turn 3 Supreme Phantom. And I was like, whoa, I've got these Lightning Helixes. They're not very good right here. In one of those games I had, Snowforge Mystic Angel Sky, it was just outclassed. But yeah, the blue-white one felt like the better of the two decks to me. This Devoted Druid deck looks pretty solid. I'll have to take this one out for a spin sometime.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't play it anymore online just because it is so many clicks. But in real life, when people throw down to demonstrated loops, I think this deck is very powerful. And I would not be surprised to see a list like this do very well in various tournaments going forward.
Yeah, and one card that I just want to briefly touch on is the benefit of playing green these days is you get this card Veil of Summer, which is like massively, ridiculously good Magic card against blue or black decks. Cryptic Command costs 4 mana. Veil of Summer, it costs 1 mana and is as good as Cryptic, maybe better against those decks. So just playing green right now actually feels like a pretty good place to be because of that card alone. Have you guys seen this card in action much?
Yeah, like when people are playing lots of Culligan's Commands, Veil of Summer becomes insane because Culligan's Command is great against Stoneforge Mystic. I know you didn't think it was that good last week, Dan, but I took a couple of Grixis control lists out for a spin and just crushed people playing Stoneforge lists, which felt so good. And they were not playing green. So they did learn a very harsh lesson about what life is like in Culligan Command's world.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. That's almost worth getting into, maybe not this exact second, but K-Command, what's up with that card? I was not playing the right deck for it. I was playing an aggressive deck that really could not afford to take a turn off to like hold up a 3-mana spell. But if you were playing a Grixis control list, then yeah, I can see how that's a much more enticing tool to have.
Corey Burkhardt is back, baby. Let's get hyped. But yeah, Veil of Summer was great. It's great in the mirror, the Stoneforge mirror where they're playing blue. Yeah, it's so awesome against so many spells that these white-blue decks are trying to play. Yeah. Maybe green is the way to go. I didn't like the value list I saw just playing like Collected Company and just jamming the Stoneforge package in there. That just looked really weak. But when you're protecting combo pieces with your Veil of Summer or making sure your spells resolve with Veil of Summer, that is nice.
Yeah, like I was just seeing some people complain about that card in the Blue Moon Discord. That card is actually pretty busted, Veil of Summer. I think we'll be seeing a lot of that card in the future. It's Legacy playable. Some people were like briefly main decking it in Legacy Storm.
Wow.
Because basically the best ways to attack Storm are discard and counter spells.
Right, yeah. So what was your impression of the format, Damon? I mean, did it seem like you were getting to play a lot more games? Because that is the one thing I will say. I mean, I know Dan was not happy with the unbanning, as well as being vociferously unhappy about the banning. But to me, it actually felt like I was playing real Magic games all the time. Even Storm beating me, you know, on turn 3 twice, that felt like the exception as opposed to how I expected most matches to go. Like even game ones lasted into this fifth and sixth turn just as a matter of course, and you had lots of decision points.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I played against basically mostly interactive decks, a good mix of aggressive and more mid-range decks, and then the one Grixis control list. And it was, all the matches were pretty interesting. I was slightly disheartened with how some of my opponent's draws went in the Jeskai Blade. You just have these days where you just like lose a bunch of Magic and you're just like, what's wrong with me? At one of those days.
No, then you just take a break and go hike in the Cascades or whatever and feel good again.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Tomorrow's another day. Hopefully my Banned Spirits will not have 18 power by turn 3 or 4. But yeah, Modern seems like it's... I mean, here's the thing though. You look at these lists from the weekend of the challenges and the SCG events and such. The top 8 meta there is not what I was seeing in the leagues at all. Like I don't see any Tron or Titan Shift at all, and those seem like some of the big winners. I did see Burn and Red Prowess.
So what happened this weekend in the main tournaments?
So there was an SCG event in Dallas-Fort Worth. There were no Stoneforge lists in the top 8, although I believe there were 4 in the top 16.
Yeah, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th were Stoneforge.
And there were even different kinds of Stoneforge lists. One was Pox deck, I think 2 were blue-white, and 1 was a Devoted Druid list, is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. And there was also a green-white Eldrazi with Stoneforge in 22nd place. So good variety there.
Yeah, the top 8 had burn decks. It had the winner played what we thought might be the best deck in the format. Last week, speculating, was the Urza list, and it was an Urza list that did not play Stoneforge. They played the Goblin Engineer instead, and I think the other Urza list to make the top 16 also played Goblin Engineer and not Stoneforge. So
that seems correct to me. I don't think Stone. I mean, it makes sense that it can fetch combo pieces in the same way that Goblin Engineer can, except it kind of can't because it can't get Thopter Foundry for you or any number of critical artifacts out of your deck.
Yeah, I think that's right. Exactly. The fact that so quickly people began to coalesce on non-Stoneforge lists with Urza after it was unbanned is probably a strong sign that the optimal build does not include Stoneforge Mystic right now anyway.
Well, this is just one tournament, though. I mean, there was also a Magic Online PTQ, or sorry, MCQ. It's still called MCQs.
We'll be back to PTQ soon, though, right? Players Tour.
Right. But this is still for the Mythical Championship. 409 players. Two of the top eight were Urza decks that included Stoneforge.
Hmm, interesting.
So maybe all these SCG grinders couldn't get their Stoneforge Mystics ready in time.
I mean, it's the SCG Tour is such an interesting place, because when I look at the standings and you just scroll down the list, it's so different from a GP. Like, I recognize the vast majority of these names. Like, these are SCG Tour regulars. Three burn decks in the top eight. These are three of the six players on Team Lotus Box. They all just decided burn was the deck, and three of them made top eight. So, like, the SCG Tour is, like, it's sort of like inbred meta, but it's also, like, an extremely spiky meta. I don't know if they're trying to next level each other. They're thinking hard about what's going to be preying on what, and I guess one version of their logic is that baseline is people want to try a Stoneforge or a midrange. Tron will eat that, and then Burn will eat Tron, and also does fine against Stoneforge. And that seemed to have worked. But then you look at something like the Magic Online metagame, worldwide tournaments. They're not necessarily any less grindy, but it's like a little more random. And then GPs are another story. You almost never recognize the names that finish in the top 32 of a GP. They're just like modern enthusiasts within a four-hour drive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that Burn did well, though, honestly, because the card Batterskull is just pretty good against Burn, and they have tools to answer it, but, like, still.
Well, they have tools to answer the creature, the Stoneforge Mystic itself, with, like, a Searing Blaze. If they need to bring in something like a Smash of Smithereens, that is an option, or a Searing Blood. I think it's much easier to just kill the Stoneforge and not worry about the Batterskull.
Yeah, but I mean, like, there are games where you don't have the Searing Blaze and you have to spin a bolt on it and then turn 5, they just play the Batterskull. There's times where they have, like, a Force of Negation or a Spell Pierce. Whenever I play against Burn in Legacy, like, I'm always happy to see Stoneforge Mystics show up. You have to be more careful games 2 and 3 against Smash the Smithereens or whatever, but it's still just, like, a super, like, linchpin card to help against that matchup.
I'm not saying it's a bad card, I'm just not saying that you should... I guess I'm saying that you shouldn't expect that your Burn matchup is fine just because you have a Batterskull and a Stoneforge package.
Oh, yeah.
This Burn list here plays 20 main deck spells that kill a Stoneforge.
I was looking at lists that had 4 Searing Blaze main and 4 Searing Blood side.
Right. Out of the sideboard, you're looking at Smash of Smithereens, 3 copies in the Lotus Box list, Skullcracks and Path of Exiles, and Lavamancers, too. So, like, there's plenty of tools to get around the Stoneforge package.
But I think, you know, adding red to play Lightning Helix, assuming you get to your fourth land so you can snapcast that Lightning Helix, that's a way around it. You can also play Timely Reinforcements. That's a great card that has been sort of too slow against the fastest aggro decks in Modern. But now, without the Faithless Looting decks around, maybe that is actually playable again.
By the way, did you guys notice that a brought back Martyr Proc list got 17th at the MCQ?
I did. It looks really bad to me. I'm surprised how good it was. Playing a list like that against decks... If blue-white Stoneforge is common, just feels so bad. Like, Counterspell lists just do so well against...
It's got a single Cavern of Souls. How could it go wrong?
That's true.
And a Weathered Wayfarer. A single Weathered Wayfarer, but 4 Ranger Captain of Vios to find your Weathered Wayfarer.
Well, and it has 4 Ranger Vios.
Yeah, in a meta where the blue-white decks aren't really playing that many Wraths, this deck actually, it's cool. It is featuring sort of Sinuan Steel and Consulate Crackdown. Oof. Wow.
Worth noting that the main deck has 2 Batterskulls and no swords.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a configuration I'm surprised we haven't seen more of, actually. If the swords have been a little underwhelming when I've actually seen them in play, maybe that's just the key is get the Batterskull, especially if you're going to play Brought Back, which can get you to 5 mana, so it's not necessarily going to get stuck in your hand.
Yeah, but I'm not sure about 2 Batterskull. It seems weird to me. You never want to draw it on its own, ever. You always want it with a Stoneforge, like finding a via Stoneforge Mystic.
But you're probably not playing Murder Proc when you're thinking that way. I mean, Murder Proc takes forever to win. It has to just outgrind everything. So Yeah, you can grind through a better skull by having two better skulls.
Yeah, yeah. This list looks interesting for sure.
This list has four Lotus Field in the main deck.
Yeah.
I don't know if this person listens to our podcast, but there's a lot of favorites in here. Brought Back, Lotus Field, Ranger Captain of Eos. It's all here.
This list is like a month of our podcast all in one nice spot.
So yeah, I guess my conclusion is obviously very early in the format. Stoneforge Mystic seems to have made the game significantly slower. I felt like I got a fourth turn every game I played except for against Storm, and Stoneforge Mystic was not like a turn two, you secretly win the game and I didn't have a chance, but I got to play a bunch of turns to create the illusion of that. I won multiple games that my opponent played a turn two Stoneforge Mystic. That tells you it should have been unbanned a long time ago, honestly, I think, especially when Faithless Looting decks were so much faster. But in this format, it felt like there's tons of decisions to be made, lots of interesting choices can be made. There are certain things that are, I think, obsoleted by the ubiquitousness of a turn two Batterskull, but the format just seems actually a lot more open if you're willing to pay sort of the new iron price that Modern asks of you as opposed to the old one.
I mean, I think that it's true that the games tend to be slower. However, if the games all go to turn four and they all feature Stoneforge Mystic, then it could be a little bit degenerate of a format. And so it remains to be seen whether Stoneforge Mystic was a Stoneforge mistake, as Dan put as the title last week, which took me by surprise.
I will change it to a question mark just for you, Damon.
Oh, okay.
Stoneforge Mistake? Question mark.
And Dan's little moment of silence for Faithless Looting and his sign-off note after the last music plays.
You know, I don't have strong feelings about the card Stoneforge Mystic. I just think it's a distraction from the real crime here, which was the Faithless Looting ban. And I think that, Dave, part of what you're summarizing right now is the state of things if you were to play in a Magic Online League right now, where there's kind of like a handshake agreement that everyone is just going to screw around with mid-range decks. But like, that's not what won the SCG event. Top four decks there were pretty much linear decks that just tried to just avoid whatever the opponent was trying to interact with. Those decks didn't suddenly become bad. There was like a Titan Shift deck there, Urza Combo, Burn, and I forgot what was the fourth one.
Grixis Death Shadow was the fourth.
Oh, well, okay, that one's... Can't complain about Death Shadow.
There was actually a really cool Rakdos mid-range list that was sort of like the old Faithless Looting Mardu Pyromancer list, but obviously lost the white portion of it and Faithless Looting, but it played like Bedroom Reveler, Liliana the Veil, Blood Moon, Culligan's Command. Kind of a cool list. I don't know if this like is a list that can succeed as Modern is going to, you know, obviously get more streamlined as the hive mind works its way through stuff, but it was really cool to see him basically port most of those cards and try to find a way to play them.
Are you talking about John Lim's 7th place deck?
Yes. 4 Season Pyromancer, 3 Bedroom Reveler.
Yeah, that is a spicy one for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really knows what to make of this list. It's crazy. 3 Blood Moons just for fun.
This seems like a terrible deck for Bedlam Reveler. There's only 17 instants and sorceries and no Faithless Looting to like dig through the deck. You're actually losing sorceries out of your deck every time you flash them back with Arcanist.
Yeah, there's a lot of choices here. I would just love to... I don't know if he did a deck tech or whatever. I mean, I'm sure in his mind, Seasoned Pyromancer is the card that like filters through, you know, the Inquisitions and Thoughtseizes in the late game to put those in the graveyard for your Bedroom Revelers, but... Or maybe you even discard the Bedroom Reveler early to your Seasoned Pyromancer or your Liliana the Veil. I don't know, but I didn't get to watch much of the tournament itself, so I didn't see the games.
To me, this deck feels misbuilt, and if he still did this well with it, with this many peculiar choices, then maybe there's really something worth looking at here, is something really powerful. Cards we don't really see, the new 3-mana Chandra from Core 2020, in kind of like a Snapcaster role. If you think back to how Mardu Pyromancer used to work, way back when, it had 4 Faithless Looting, and usually 4 Bedlam Revelers, and that was how you eventually won the game most of the time. You wanted to like reach a board state where your last card in hand was a Reveler. And you could do that just by discarding them earlier to lootings, and you eventually K-Command them, one of them back to your hand, and the chain goes off that way. So like that element is actually still present here. There's 2 K-Commands, 3 Revelers, and then you can rebuy the K-Command with this Chandra. Discard outlets like Seasoned Pyromancer, Liliana the Veil, so like, you're never really like stuck with the Bedlam Reveler in hand if you can't cast it, which seems like you rarely can cast it here. It's interesting. I think this is something to work on in this shell, for sure.
Yeah, it's still a mystery. I mean, Chandra also exiles your instances of sorcerers out of your graveyard.
Well, but kudos to John Lim for the finish.
Yeah, absolutely. Innovating. Well, so I think that's a pretty good summary of kind of where the format's at. So with the new metagame being what it is, we're going to return in a little bit with some of our old brews that we're going to maybe make some tweaks to that we think would be effective against the decks that we're seeing now.
And we are back. This week, we wanted to take the opportunity, since we've been blessed with this unexpected new metagame that's all wide open, this is a great opportunity to revisit some of our old favorites. We're now in episode 19, I guess, of the podcast. And if you've been following since the beginning, you know that every week we propose a new card that we think has a lot of potential. And sometimes we're working with two or three or even four different lists that are trying to utilize different aspects of the card. And sometimes it feels like we get pretty close to breaking through and finding something that's actually powerful. And other times the card is just more of a bust. But one of the most common results is that the card actually feels kind of promising, but the metagame is just too hostile. It's not quite up to speed with all of the degeneracy that was sort of the trademark of the Faithless Looting era of Modern. So we have a clean sheet, almost a new, more mid-range-oriented, Stoneforge Mystic-oriented format. And I think this would be a great time to ask ourselves, or ask each other, if there are some cards that we had previously played around with, some decks that were on the brink that might be well positioned now and worth revisiting. Damon, I know you had some ideas on this front. Do you want to tell us what you have in mind?
Yeah, so the first deck I wanted to revisit is Kiora Behemoth Beckoner and the Glorybringer plus other dragon deck. This deck, we had a nice 5-0 a long way back. I think it was like week 3 or week 4. And the deck felt pretty good back then, and then Hogak got printed. And basically, this is we use the phrase leaky bucket. It was just impossible to have the sideboard be good against Hogak and Urza and Tron and Control, et cetera, et cetera. But fortunately, it seems that Wizards has plugged a few holes with the BNR update, so that saves us a lot of sideboard slots. So the core of the deck is it's basically a red-green Ponza shell, but instead of featuring all these Stone Rains and Pillages, which are, you know, suck in the late game off the top of the deck, it really trims down on that angle and only features a couple Blood Moons as the interaction on the land front. And then it features Kiora Behemoth Beckoner, which is a 3 CMC, 7 loyalty Planeswalker. Wow, that's a lot of loyalty. But she's a little bit narrow with what she does. Her -1 is untap target permanent. And then she has a static ability. Whenever a creature with power 4 or greater enters a battlefield under your control, you draw a card. That's all there is to it. But she synergizes super well with Utopia Sprawl, just like Arbor Elf does, so the deck features 4 of those also, and helps ramp you into cards like Glorybringer, which is just a massive 4-4 haste, and that attacks them, and then you can just kill a creature, and then Cure can even follow through and help untap your Glorybringer. So this deck is actually capable of some super explosive starts. Anything involving like double Utopia Sprawls plus a Kiora, you can actually just go nuts. I killed a burn player on turn 4 once by just Cure, untap, and pump a Glorybringer +6/+0 with Kessick Wolfrun. One of the things the deck struggled with was the graveyard decks. Hogak was just really, really good. There's no way around that. And now that deck is gone, you can really trim on graveyard slots. Dredge is still there, so it's certainly a threat, but it's not the same level of threat as Hogak was. At least we all hope. And actually, a pilot, Francis Aurelius, got a 5-0 with this on the August 30th dump. One interesting thing that they did was they featured 2 Goblin Crater Makers main deck, which is an interesting kind of flex slot utilization because this is good against Stoneforge Mystic and the equipment package, while also being a generally plausible creature to help, you know, it can do a lot of grindy, dirty work if it needs to. Yeah, so I personally don't like Bloodbraid Elf in this list. It feels way too swingy. There's just way too many one-drop mana dorks that you don't really want to hit with it. And I thought that they were not playing enough creatures with power 4 or greater to trigger Kiora. So I tuned the numbers a little bit and then played some Veil of Summers, which I think is just a great card. If you're playing green, like, why not play Veil of Summer? What do you guys think?
I think it's funny that you said you tuned the numbers a little bit, because I'm looking at it right now and it's like 12 one-offs. It's like you took a piano that was roughly in tune and just sort of untuned it a little bit to get a more variety.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like that, but it's not quite as all over the place as It looks, so there's like one Birds and one Noble Hierarch. Those are functionally quite similar. It could just be two of one, but honestly, I wasn't really sure which one is better. There's a BBE, a Rekindling Phoenix, and a Vengevine at the 4 CMC slot. And these all perform similar roles. Two of them are hasty, two of them trigger Kiora. It's not clear which one is kind of like the best of the three. At the 5 CMC, there's just like a bunch of dragons in red. Glorybringer is a cut above the rest, no doubt. But then the second tier level ones, Stormbreath Dragon, Thundermar Hellkite, and a new one, Scargan Hellkite, which has Riot. And so it can become either a 5-5 or a 4-4 with haste. And then if you have a +1/+1 counter, then it has this ability that lets you spend 4 mana to deal 2 damage to anything, which is actually pretty powerful. It's just like a nice little ability. This deck occasionally generates a lot of mana, and so sometimes you'll just have 8 mana and use that twice. And then there's a Lone Thragtusk, which, I don't know, that card is similar to the dragons but doesn't have haste, but it's just a good 5 CMC card.
This is a good example of brewing by numbers on the mana curve. You decided you want 8 5 drops. At that point, you divvy them up as follows. 4 Glorybringer, that's the best one. 2 Scargan Hellkite, 1 Stormbreath, 1 Thragtusk, just because. Same with the 4 drops. It's just interesting to see which cards here are deemed worthy of being 4 ofs. The Gruul Spellbreaker is a 4 of in this build.
Yeah, I mean, there's like the cards that you just sort of want to see one or more of every match. And then cards you want to see kind of like one of every match, but not really more than that. And then cards where you don't mind not seeing it. It's like Kiora's a 3 of just because she's not very good in multiples. But yeah, brewing by numbers.
And it looks like you're a little bit down on Blood Moon in the current meta. There's only 2 right now on the main deck, 1 on the side.
Yeah, I'm not sure on this. I think I need to take the list out for a spin to really see how Blood Moon feels. I haven't cast a Blood Moon in a fair amount of time. But certainly, it can be really good against humans if you get it early enough. It can be too slow. People's mana bases are pretty greedy these days, so it actually might be a good time to be playing 3 or maybe even 4. What do you guys think on that number?
I never even liked when we were playing 3 or 4 before. When I was playing the list, I was always playing 2, so I actually like it. I don't like the 1 Raging Ravine. I know that the 5-0 list had it. The times when you don't get to play your 1 drop on 1, but you have the Raging Ravine, it just feels like it's never worth it to me.
Yeah, that was a new thing that I saw from this 5-0 list. The cut I made for it actually was I cut one of the Noble Hierarchs. It felt like with a Ren and 6 metagame, I haven't seen too much Ren and 6 lately, but like the card is still kind of scary if you're playing Arbor Elves on turn 1. So going out of 6 one-mana creatures and then adding a land felt reasonable, but I know what you're saying.
Have you guys seen a lot of Jund? I don't think I've actually played against it. I'm also, I share your like concerns. I'm always like, I don't want to play too many 1-drops because Ren 6 just gets these free wins against you, and then I just don't see Ren 6 anymore.
Yeah, putting us on one set of 10 matches. It's true. There isn't that much Jund these days. It didn't really seem to do well in the deck dumps.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's always like one Jund list, but the fact that it doesn't kill Stoneforge Mystic, and Stoneforge Mystic eventually, you know, puts creatures into play. You can play your crappy little creature and equip it. And then Giver of Ruins also having 2 toughness maybe means that the mid-range deck of choice is not Jund and is going to be a deck that can play Counterspell.
Yeah, Jund definitely shows up in smatterings in the top 32 of the MCQ. But yeah, Jund is a weird deck because it's always so popular and then it just never really seems to show up as much as you would think.
This theory might be stupid, but do you think it has a mana traders problem? Like it doesn't fit under the rental limit?
How many ticks are these Jund lists?
So I'm just looking at Ren and 6 right now. It is currently 132 tickets online for one Ren and 6. Mana Traders, the mid-tier subscription, allows you to get 350 tickets at a time worth of cards. This is kind of like a running sub-theme in the Niv-Mizzet Discord. People are high on Ren and 6, but it's like, oh, I want to play the deck in a league, and Teferi Time Rattler is up to 50 tickets right now. You want to play 2 of those. Can you even fit a Ren and 6 on the deck without putting yourself over the Mana Traders cap? We'd love to play 3, but we just can't.
Wow, these decks are getting expensive.
Prismatic Vistas, 25 ticks. So full set of that, that's 100 ticks. 200 ticks with 2 Teferis, 1 Ren and 6, you're all the way up to 230 or 330 tickets.
I don't think that's crazy, and it is interesting that on MTGO, I think half of the most expensive cards have been printed in the last 6 months. With Arena cannibalizing how many packs get opened, especially in newer sets, because there's not that much standard being played. And then, of course, like Modern Horizons was specifically designed to be this way, to be a little bit of a cash grab for WotC. Yeah, I mean, you see almost by design what's going to happen is all these new cards, there aren't that many of them. And now they're needed because some of them are at this super high power level that Modern sort of requires you to play cards with that base power level just to be competitive. There were four Jund lists in the top 32 of the Modern Open in Dallas-Fort Worth, the SCG Open, by the way.
That's actually quite a lot.
Four in the top 32?
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
That is a ton. That is a ton.
For what's supposed to be like a...
It was supposed to be one of our new pillars of the format.
What, it's like 12.5%? That's a lot. What deck ever achieves that metagame share in an open field?
Burn definitely did better.
Yeah.
I think Tron had a better... Yeah, okay, you're right, Dan. I guess four copies is not bad. And it didn't quite make the top eight.
I think that objectively, four out of the top 32 is a great showing for any deck in Modern.
Well, there you have it. So I think it's reasonable to play a 23rd land then, because of our Jund Overlords. We have to show some respect.
Also, one thing to mention is that this whole red-green list online costs about as much as a single Renin 6, clocking in at 162 ticks. This is a pretty good online budget list, if that's a concern. Also, in paper, it clocks in at 480, which is certainly not cheap, but cheaper than a lot of the other Modern decks.
I did want to ask you if you think Renin 6 would add anything to the deck.
Yeah, about 130 ticks.
I do not think this is a good deck for Renin 6. The extra lands are not worth anything. This is still a very aggressive deck. I do like the Vengevine. I know we didn't play it on our 5-0 list, but I think there is a Discord that kept iterating after we sort of put the deck down and played several Vengevines over the Bloodbraid Elves. And that actually always was very attractive to me. You do end up with lots of like little crappy creatures. So being able to turn like a bird and a Goblin Cratermaker in the late game into another Vengevine that might draw a card if you have a cure in play seems very attractive.
Yeah, I tried a few leagues with this list a month or so ago, and I literally never triggered the Vengevine once. And so it sounds good in theory, but I'm not convinced it's good in practice.
Fair.
Maybe if I was playing more Bloodbraid Elves, it would turn like the stupid Bloodbraid into Arbor Elf. Actually would make it something I would be happy about.
Oh, so maybe you do like a two Bloodbraid, two Vengevine kind of a split.
Yeah, maybe.
It's worth thinking about the history of this deck. Just this is maybe in my own head. The history of the deck is as follows. We were playing this shortly after War of the Spark was released. So before Horizons came out. In what I think of now as kind of like a golden age of Modern.
Ah, yes. The
Karn, great creator.
The sepia-toned images of our youth.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it was a time of experimentation. They were powerful decks, but you kind of knew what they were and you could beat them. There was no Pro Tour in this format because for some reason, the War of the Spark Pro Tour did not allow you to play War of the Spark cards. And yeah, the previously best decks like Phoenix were somewhat on the downswing because people were trying out the new War of the Spark editions. Anyway, that's somewhat beside the point. But we liked the deck a lot, and Dave, you're referring to the fine folks in the sort of Ponza subreddit recognize this as another green-red rampy deck that you can use Blood Moon. And so they had tried it with a list that played four Vengevines and four Bloodbraid Elves, and then replaced Blood Moons with Magus of the Moon, got Rabble Masters in there. Like, still had a Kiora, big mana, a Glorybringer essence of the deck, but it wasn't just like, let's add a Vengevine or two. It was like, let's reconfigure the entire deck to get Vengevines in there. Then Horizons happened, and the deck, as Damon was saying, it just became completely unviable because green red is absolutely horrible at fighting graveyard decks. I also think the deck had somewhat of a Lava Dart Renin 6 problem. All mana dork based decks were just sort of pushed out of the format during Hogak Summer. So yeah, I mean, now I think it's a good time. I think the Lava Dart decks have drastically died off. They may be non-existent right now. And Renin 6, for whatever reason, is not prevalent in the online queues. Graveyard decks are pretty much being quiet for the most part. Sodex Dredge list notwithstanding. Yeah, maybe we can play Arbor Elves again.
Yeah, and Ancient Grudge seems quite good right now.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, so red-green is poor at fighting graveyard, but actually quite good at fighting random artifacts.
I will say the Oof is actually not a good anti-artifact card in my experience. Watching the various games against Wurza, because they are playing red, they're just main decking some amount of, you know, bolts or whatever, and after board they've got a ton of ways to kill Oof. I just saw it multiple times. They would just kind of wait in the weeds until they decided to go off and then just kill the Oof end of turn against whatever deck was hoping to use that to thwart them. So yeah, cards like Cindervines or Ancient Grudge that actually permanently kill artifacts are much more powerful.
Yeah, I think Oof is much more of like a flex hitter that comes in against perhaps Aether Vial decks. It's good against equipment decks. It's good against Tron. It is not great against Wurza. I completely agree with that. It's okay against Wurza.
Yeah, it'll trade, but they want to play creature removal anyway because there's so many Stormforges, et cetera, running around. So everyone has a way to kill a creature with two toughness if they want to. But yeah, I think you're right, Damon. Those other decks are where it shines.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the sideboard definitely still needs some thinking. For example, I didn't manage to fit in any Abrades, which I think are good in a meta with a lot of Aether Vial decks running around. And then Shatterstorm is like a red powerhouse against like just a Wurza deck.
Abrade is like the red K command. Kill the Stoneforge if you want, or kill the Batterskull if you want. It's great.
Yeah, so maybe it should just be like tweak the numbers. Maybe only one Grudge, one Abrade, or maybe cut the Collector Oof in favor of Abrade.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I love this deck, so I might play it this week myself just for old time's sake. And I will probably not be playing the same numbers you are playing, Damon. I will probably streamline it somewhat.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, honestly, Renin 6 is interesting in this deck. My instinct is it's not good, but it's just such a powerful card.
No, I think I'm persuaded by your points. I'm looking to see like what I could use the ultimate of Renin 6 for, and there is one Lightning Bolt.
Yeah.
Well, the one Lightning Bolt could be wrong. The 5-0 list had four. I don't like Lightning Bolt that much.
I don't like it either.
I kind of love Lightning Bolt in this format, so...
It's true that Lightning Bolt is good, but one of the reasons you play this deck is because what's better than Lightning Bolt is Glorybringer.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you already have four Glorybringers. I'm more into like a Lightning Bolt than like a Skargon Hellkite or...
Sounds like somebody who's never cast a Skargon Hellkite.
Maybe not.
Have you ever cast a Skargon Hellkite, Dave?
I have.
Have you ever cast a Skargon Hellkite?
Not with Kyoru in play.
Okay. But yeah, no, it's true. Like, Lightning Bolt is actually seems to be really good right now, and this deck is not playing as many as it could. Something to think about.
But if we want to talk about another deck that plays mana creatures and 5-mana dragons, we had speculated that if the format got mid-rangey, then a return of America's favorite deck, I think, 5-color Niv-Mizzet could come back.
This has the colors of every flag in its Niv-Mizzet's casting cost, unless you have orange.
Yeah, Italian, Nigerian. No Irish are allowed, really, but other than that.
Whoa. Yeah, so Niv-Mizzet's Bring to Light is a deck that we've just had a lot of fun with on this cast and played a lot of, that Dan and I took to GP Minneapolis. It's been showing up consistently in the 5-0 dumps from a number of different pilots, all with their own unique configurations, because the deck has almost infinite flexibility with how you can muck around. The key constraint being that to play well with Niv-Mizzet Reborn, you want to play cards that are from one of the 10 two-color guilds and really minimize the cards that are not from a guild. The deck actually, I mean, managed to be putting up decent results all throughout Hogak Summer, which is, this type of deck was really just not good against that. But against mid-range decks, this deck is borderline oppressive. As soon as you cast a single Niv-Mizzet and resolve it, and you fill your hand up with trophies, K-commands, another Bring to Light, the game just tends to end. And so this seems like a really good deck to kind of go over the top of the mid-range decks in the same way that a Tron deck does, but with a lot more kind of early interaction and in some sense a more resilient mana base than Tron, in some sense a less resilient mana base.
Oh, I think it's much more resilient. Much more resilient. The cards that you would bring in against Tron don't actually really work against this deck.
I've been wrecked by a Fulminator Mage a couple of times. But, I mean, I think this deck just occasionally the mana base fails to launch in a way that Tron also fails to launch too. But the hands where you have like two pillars and a birds or two pillars and a Breeding Pool and a Astrolabe.
I think you just keep those hands. Honestly, I think those are good hands.
And you just hope to draw into the right mana sources for your...
Yeah, you just have to trust that you constructed the deck correctly, that you will draw the land. You don't have to be able to cast every card in your opening hand, right? So, like, why put that same pressure on the Astrolabe? It doesn't really matter what turn you cast it if you have two rainbow sources and the pillars.
Yeah, it's scary, though, because it means all the other Astrolabes you'll draw into are also dead until you find a way out of it.
Trust the pillars. It's the best land in the deck. Trust the pillars.
It's trust but verify, and when you verify that your hand can't cast any of the spells in it, that's when you have to mulligan. But yeah, so one thing I like about this deck is that in the post-Hogak slightly slower world, the deck can adapt quite flexibly, and some of the gilded cards, they're not always the most efficient cards that Magic has seen to do their role. Like, Rest in Peace is just a little bit more efficient than Wheel of Sun and Moon at what it does, and nothing quite beats Path to Exile at what that card does. But in a slightly slower world, you can play these gilded cards, which frequently actually are perhaps slightly more powerful, but slightly more expensive too. if you have time to do all this, the deck really can go over the top. And it can comfortably play sweepers, which I think are good against all the creature decks, and then just kind of up the count of K command to help against Stoneforge Mystic. It also has plenty of other answers to Stoneforge Mystic along the way, and then bring in a couple more general purpose answers in the sideboard now that you can save space on the ley lines.
I see that the list you've got drawn up here is pretty close to what you took to a very strong finish at Minneapolis. That was a, 94th place finish, cash finish with Niv. Very nice.
Yeah.
But the deck has so many flex slots, so cards that I think were excellent during Hogak Summer might not be as good anymore. So you have that the Kaya Orzhov Usurper is still in the main deck. Ice Fang Quetzal in the main deck. Unmoored Eagle in the main deck. Do you think those are still good choices?
Well, I just came out of a league against Boros Burn, Red Prowess, Humans, Dredge, and Banned Spirits, and Kaya would have been excellent in all of those. Before that, it was against Jund, Mill, Eldrazi, Zombie, Grixis Control, Stoneblade. And yeah, I mean, I'm not sure on Kaya, but I think there are a lot of 1 CMC cards for her to exile. Ice Fang, I think, is like an interesting one because it feels a little bit... The reasons we didn't like it were that it hits your Simic slot, and it's fighting as Bring to Light, which is almost always the correct choice off Niv. You almost always want to pick the Bring to Light so you can chain Nivs or get a critical card. But that said, I think Quetzal is actually a strong card on its own, and it's good at blocking a lot of like the early Piddlers or Batterskull tokens and slow them down a lot. Like a single Batterskull, if it attacks into an Ice Fang Quetzal, it takes them 5 mana to reset it, which is just a lot.
The reason I didn't like it was mainly that it was only good against midrange, and those decks didn't exist in Hogak Summer. But if that's the format we're in now, then yeah, I can see why its value would be on the rise again.
Yeah. Unmoored Eagle is interesting. I mean, that card is certainly a very strange card in Modern. You don't see it played too often, but it is good against Tron and Titan Shift. It's good against Wurza if you can get to it in time. It's okay in the other matchups. This deck tends to shine in the midrange matchups already, so having like one bad card against like Jund feels acceptable.
I agree. Verdict in the main or in the sideboard?
I don't know. It could maybe be main deck, but the deck already features so much removal that you only really need it against the true kind of creature mass decks. For now, I have it in the sideboard, but that could be subject to change. I do not like the Elodomri's Call quite as much in a world where Anafenza is not a good card to get. Kaya's Guile is an interesting card. I think nobody really actually still understands how good Kaya's Guile is. We all have a feeling of how good K-Command is as this 3 CMC instant with a bunch of flexible modes, and that we know about how good the ceiling is and about how good the floor is. Kaya's Guile is sort of weirder.
Yeah, I still like having one because it's your only real main deck way to exile the graveyards off of Bring to Light, which could come up if you're playing against Dredge. You might actually win game one if you can do that.
Yeah, honestly, against Thopter's Sword combo at the right time, that can really mess them up.
Yeah, so the basic principles of Niv, we outlined them in some detail a couple weeks back. That was episode 16, I want to say. If you can trade your cards for their cards, the deck is great, and the removal of Arclight Phoenix and sort of graveyard-based recursion decks makes all the spot removal so much better than it was before. There's no reason why this deck shouldn't be great. It's just a matter of finding the right cards. I think we have a good read on what works and what doesn't. So I expect this build to do well, and I will probably try this as well myself, because I love this deck.
Yeah, this deck is a joy to pilot.
It has a mana traders problem. The list you sent me is 620 tickets online.
I know, it's insane. The online cost is almost the same as the paper cost.
A lot of it is tied up in the Modern Horizons cards you're choosing to play.
Yeah, about half of it is Ren and 6.
And 4 Prismatic Vista.
And 3 Teferis. That's most of the deck right there.
The sideboard needs a Fracturing Gust, so we can maybe cut the Teferi for it.
Yeah. So I think probably this deck wins the prize for the most frequently asked about deck on the Modern subreddit. Like, it seems like every 2 or 3 days there's someone posting like, hey, what's the deal with this deck? Some brave soldier is like, go to the Discord. Check out this episode of the Faithless Brewing. Something about it captures the imagination. The deck is actually really good. So join the Discord, listen to our previous episodes about it. It's going to be great. Not everyone is a believer yet. They were going through the deck dump on the Arena Decklist podcast with Jerry Thompson and Brian Gottlieb. And there were 2 Niv decks in that Friday deck dump. I think they still think it's a meme deck. I'm going to work my angles, see if I can get Jerry to come around and maybe get him to play it. I'll see what it takes to bribe him to play this deck. He'll come to see the light.
He will be
brought to the light.
Yes, exactly.
So, Kiora and Niv, those are two longtime favorites of the cast, but Dave, you have another list in mind.
Yeah, so when Damon said that he played a Grixis control list that just drew very well against him and its cards matched up very well, and he said it wasn't that competitive, I was like, man, that's what I want to be doing. I mean, I love casting Culligan's Command. And I basically brewed up a list that ended up pretty close. Corey Burkhardt has an article on Channel Fireball. He played Grixis Control to an 8-2 finish at a Pro Tour right before the unbanned Jace. So this would be like early 2018. And he was famous at the time for playing 8 commands, 4 Culligan's Command, 4 Cryptic Command. I didn't get that optimistic, but I kept the basic shell of 4 Thought Scour, 4 Lightning Bolt, 2 Tassiger, 4 Snapcaster Mage, and then 4 Culligan's Command. I played 2 Cryptic Command, and then based on Damon's feedback, I added in Jess is her name.
Kess,
whatever.
Whatever.
She was awesome. You have new sideboard angles against Lingering Souls, which is a very powerful card. You can play Plague Engineer, which I highly recommend. Played Ceremonious Rejection in the sideboard to combat Tron. Plus, you can play various land destruction spells if you want. The deck just felt awesome.
Do you have a list?
Yeah, I'll post it. I don't have it to share right now.
Damn it, Dave.
I've been on a different computer.
He just told us what was in the deck.
Okay, it's just not how my mind works, but...
Yeah, the two cards that are insane are Spell Snare and Culligan's Command. Spell Snare is as powerful as it's ever been. Every deck has a powerful 2-drop. Being able to Snapcaster a Spell Snare is amazing.
So, Dave, how many Spell Snares are you on?
I was playing 2 in the main, 1 in the board.
Wow.
And then I was playing a full set of Inquisition main, which I wasn't loving as much. Maybe I'd go down to 3 there. Because there's no, like, graveyard interaction per se, you can play your Tassiger without too much fear of, like, them shutting it off game 2 with Rest in Peace. It's not, like, quite good enough to justify bringing in, or if they do, it's kind of a dead card if you decided to sort of beat them now with Snapcasters. Yeah, the deck just feels great against other Stoneforge lists. I think there are weaker matchups against sort of some of the grindier decks, some of the big mana decks. I'm not sure like how good it is against decks that are trying to resolve Primeval Titan, for instance. But yeah, if you want to just beat up on kids playing Stoneforge Mystic, I would recommend playing a bunch of Culligan's Commands and some amount of Spell Snares and Snapcaster Mages.
So a question for you then, if you get the matchup you want there, like why does that work? Is it just because you have more 2-for-1s in the deck than they do?
Yeah, so basically you can trade cheaply 2-for-1. Like Stoneforge Mystic is a 2-for-1, but that second card matters so late in the game. And by then you've just accrued so much advantage. I was just beating up on these Jeskai lists. They just don't do anything. Like they play their 1-2, you have all these 1-mana removal spells. Even if they get to try to resolve it at the end of turn, you can Culligan's Command kill it. If they don't resolve it, you just sit there staring at each other, but you have all these reactive cards. Yeah, it felt great. Spell Snare going up a mana, like so even on the draw, you can still get their Stoneforge Mystic, so it doesn't even resolve. And you can also proactively, you have Hand Disruption, so you don't have to be the first one to like play into it. You're only committing 1 mana and 1 card to go after their Stoneforge or their Counterspell or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. In Legacy, there's basically a Grixis Control deck that exists that is maybe out of meta right now, but was historically quite good. And Stoneblade versus Grixis Control always felt pretty close. So I'm not convinced that it's like a natural predator of Stoneblade decks. But I need to play the matchup out a little bit more to get a better feel for it.
Do you think there's maybe some cards in Legacy that help prop up Stoneblade? Maybe some of the free counterspells or something that are tipping the matchup more?
Maybe it's that I just play a bunch of like Spell Pierces, and Trinium Nemesis can frequently be a problem for Grixis Control.
Yeah, like those cards would be a nightmare against the deck I'm proposing. And I don't think there's much room for Spell Pierce the way the current like Jeskai builds are constructed.
Yeah, the Jeskai list I played had 2 of them. They felt pretty good, actually. I like Spell Pierce right now, in the same way that you like Spell Snare.
It's definitely a good card in the mirror, and I think when you think back to Standard, the scourge of the Stoneblade days, Spell Pierce was a crucial card back then.
Yeah, the problem is that Spell Pierce just like sucks with Path to Exile.
Yeah.
Feels terrible.
Spell Snare. I mean, there you go.
Yeah.
Just play 4. Maybe not 4.
Even 3 is probably excessive. 2 main for sure. I don't know if you need to even have the 3rd in the board, but it is a sweet card.
Would you ever play, this is just a random question, but Ancestral Vision in your Grixis Control list? It feels like that card might be pretty good right now.
I'm not a Grixis control guru by any stretch of the imagination. I'm really interested to see what Corey Burkhart brews. He even tweeted out that like he might be back in business. So I'm kind of interested to see what kind of updates he makes. I wasn't playing Jace, for instance. Maybe that's what you want to play on four. Yeah, maybe Ancestral Visions as a sideboard card in certain matchups.
If the meta's slower, Ancestral Vision is just like a pretty good card.
Yes.
It's good until they play a Teferi.
Right. You do have a hard time killing Planeswalkers in this list.
Yeah, that's also one reason why in Legacy the Stoneblade felt okay, is I think it's a slightly higher number of Planeswalkers and threats. There's no wrong threats, only wrong answers to some extent.
So would you be interested in that Grixis deck, Dave, if K-Command were not like a well-positioned card?
Oh, no.
So it's really like a K-Command deck.
Yeah, I mean, it just sets up these loops. If it's not going to get the easy, like, kill a creature, kill an artifact, and there are lots of decks that are using artifacts right now, just like when you're down to basically no cards in hand, just such an amazing top deck. Like, you steal their draw in their draw step and get back a Snapcaster Mage, and then you get to do it again next turn.
Yeah, K-Command with Snapcaster is just such a good pairing.
So it's reasonable early because it's trading for a resource that everyone is playing, which is like tons of creatures with two toughness. And then it's very reasonable late because it sets up basically sort of like the Bring to Light chain. It sets up this sort of unbeatable series of value plays. I beat a Niv-Mizzet list, in fact, going into the late game with Culligan's Command.
How was Kess for you?
It was awesome. It was really good. It also blocks flying creatures, which matters. Lingering Souls was a card that I was having problems with because when I built it, my first build didn't have Plague Engineer in the sideboard. So Lingering Souls is a really hard deck for this to beat because Culligan's Command does not line up well against it and I'm not playing Electrolyze. So she at least blocks. She shuts down all that stuff. She's like a legitimate attacker in the air. She is resistant to Lightning Bolt herself. Yeah, very good card. I was playing one of the 4-4 Dragon that makes them discard and can pay 7 mana.
Oh, what's that card named? It's only one of Magic's most iconic villains, Nicol Bolas, the Ravager.
Yeah, that wasn't that good. I think I'd maybe either play 2 Kess or maybe 1 Jace instead of the Dragon. I don't think I ever transformed it.
Nikki B doesn't quite seem like a modern card.
No. Again, like Grixis Control is very customizable. You can play P and Kieran Nalar, which is something that Corey Burkhart did in the last Pro Tour. You can play Jace, which was not printed then. I don't know if he would have played it at the time. You can play 2 of Kess. You can play an extra card with Delve if you want to play, you know, maybe 2 Tasigur and more of the Logic Knot. So it all depends on what cards you like. It's pretty flexible to allow for lots of cheap ways to interact with the opponent.
If your opponent slides in 4 Veil of Summer, can you win?
I don't think so, man, honestly. Maybe you can Surgical the first one.
We found the line.
But yeah, if that card becomes common, this deck is unplayable. That is a great point. I did not play against a list that had it, but if I did, I would have certainly lost.
Both this list and the Niv-Mizzet list that you were proposing, Damon, are in some sense Culligan's Command decks. I like everything you're saying about Spell Snare being a well-positioned interactive piece to get you ahead on tempo. I think also the Grixis deck seems to know its role. You sit down and you know what you want to do each game. You just want to settle in, get some value, remove their threats, destroy their permanents, kind of like Niv-Mizzet. But then you have these powerful, clean 2-for-1s throughout the game.
Are you playing Thought Scour?
Yeah, that is my only cantrip for Thought Scour. Fuels the graveyard for your Delve cards. Helps you sort of find your like one of, two ofs to flash back with Snapcaster.
Oh yeah, it makes tons of sense. But yeah, Dan, I agree with what you're saying, that Grixis Control and Niv kind of share a theme of just kind of trying to out card advantage and out grind.
Niv-Mizzet is definitely, definitely significantly less weak to Veil of Summer, though. So if you're afraid of that card, I would play Niv-Mizzet, not Grixis Control.
Time will tell.
We should make a Bant list with Snapcaster Mage, Veil of Summer.
Basically, every time you cast a Veil of Summer, it's like they took a mulligan and you unmulliganed.
Yeah, makes me want to Snapcast it back.
I know. And Blue-Green gets a cool new Planeswalker that makes food tokens. Who knows what will be brewing in a month or two.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so for my part, actually, I feel like I have unfinished business with Stoneforge Mystic and some of the white lists that we talked about. So Force of Virtue, I forgot that we'd done a week on that. I think that card is still knocking at the door. like to explore some of those lists. I was chatting with a couple people on Reddit after our last episode about some interesting white-based Stoneforge decks. One of the lists that was proposed was a, I shouldn't say Murder Proc, because Proclamation of Rebirth is just like no longer part of the deck. It's Murder Back? Murder Back, is that?
Yeah, there you go.
More like a Murder Back deck with Stoneforge that I would like to explore that a little bit. So there's a lot to relearn, I guess. The whole outlook changes when the meta shifts like this. War meta's rotated, so gotta redo all our work.
Yeah, there was a list that XJet Cloud was tearing up Legacy with recently that I guess is nicknamed Squad Stompy.
Is this the Force of Virtue Legacy deck?
Yeah, featuring 4 Squadron Hawk, 4 Vampire Conquistador, and 4, what's that, like, Foot Battle Soldier? Battlefoot Soldier?
That doesn't sound like a real card.
You know I don't know the name of this card.
It's a card that's the same as Vampire Conquistador, but it's like a human soldier instead. I forget the name offhand. So you feature 3 Squadron cards, and then some Chalices and Thalias, and Force of Virtue.
And when you say Vampire Conquistador, do you mean Vicious Conquistador, or Legion Conquistador?
It's the one that costs 2 and a white.
The Pearled Unicorn, Grey Ogre.
Yeah, Legion Conquistador.
Okay, and there's a new one from Core 2020, the Battalion Foot Soldier.
I got all the right words in all the wrong order.
We knew what you meant, though.
Was he playing Oketra's Monument?
Oh, yes, that card. That was a Lynchman card. Modern does not have the soul mana sources to power it out quite as early, though.
You just play a Simian Spirit Guide. There you go.
Yeah.
You'll get all your cards back with these battalions.
Is Chromebox Modern legal? I don't even remember, to be honest.
No, it is banned.
Okay. Because that was one of the cards that actually pairs super well with the Squadron cards.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I watched Jim Davis stream it, and he played against like 4K command decks that just wrecked him. It was pretty funny.
Amazing. So yeah, I don't think I want to be playing Battalion Foot Soldier in Modern, but I am willing to play Force of Virtue and Squadron Hog.
Yeah, no Oketra's Monument.
I'm open to it. Some of the cards you've mentioned have appeared in Oketra's Monument Modern decks. I'm not going to say they did well, but they were published, so that's something.
Yeah, my concern is that you're playing this artifact, and now this is a bad time, I think, to be playing artifacts, because there's all kinds of sideboard hate against it, so it's a tough type to try to rely on.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, oh, you know what would be a great deck that felt like it was really almost there was the Bolas of Siddle deck, and then, like, oh, wait, no, never mind.
That deck was never almost there.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with that assessment.
It was actually quite good. You couldn't rely on Trash for Treasure because there was so much graveyard hate.
Now you can't rely on Bolas of Citadel because everyone's going to be shattering it for 2 mana.
Now you have to kill them the turn you play it, which is a lot harder. So I'm not ready to go back there yet. Got to grind some leagues with Niv to pad the stash of tickets to play with first before I can incinerate them all on more Bolas of Citadel decks.
You do you, Dan, on that one.
Yeah, just feeling some type of way.
I'll be happy to live the Bolas of Citadel dream vicariously through you.
I feel like we need another bet, actually. I'm sensing some doubt from the two of you on Bolas of Citadel. I forgot to mention, so I...
You are owed a lot of cookies, which is something we did not touch on. There are a lot of Stoneforge Mystic decks in the deck dumps.
I was owed, but the debt has been paid.
Yeah, so I think the number was 15 and a half. What was the final number? 26, 27, 28? It was in the high 20s.
So I offered you a line of 18 as a baseline.
First of all, you should have offered a half number. That's amateur hour. 18 and a half is a number. There's no pushes, man. Come on.
Fair enough. And you took the under. You predicted like 12. There were 27. And Dave, like a gentleman, slaved away all of Friday baking some fresh cookies. Sent them to me, and I enjoyed them all weekend. Very delicious. He sent me a full dozen cookies, actually.
Would you, like, next day them or something?
No, I ordered them from a local establishment in New Haven.
Wait, you didn't bake those fresh? Oh.
I went to their site and baked it there. I became an employee for 4 hours.
So you next day'd yourself?
Exactly. Flew out to New Haven.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you're interested in receiving some cookies of your own, I mean, we can...
So the problem is, I don't want you to incinerate any more of your time pursuing this when we could be looking at actually useful brews. So
the more you say things like that, the more likely it is I'm going to play Bolas of Citadel.
You just said you didn't want to play it. We agreed with you. And then somehow you decided we were agreeing with you too vociferously.
Exactly.
So, Dan, what do you set the lineup for this one? I would also be interested in taking this bet against you never 5-0ing with Bolas of Citadel.
1-5-0 before I die.
I'm putting the odds at 50,000 to 1.
You can collect your cookies at the wake.
I would almost actually consider.
Yeah. All right. Well, we can ponder that one for a while. We'll think of more fair terms.
What about you could play Bolas of Citadel as many times as you want for the next week? And if you get a 5-0.
And if I don't?
Well, cookies. You get cookies if you get the 5-0. We get cookies if you don't.
How many leagues do I estimate I will need to get a good list? And how much time do I have this week?
And I mean, the reality is a good list can go 4-1 a bunch of times. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're going to 5-0.
I have several 4-1s with both the Citadels and some 1-4s and an 0-5.
That's true. You were actually getting the deck to perform a lot better for you. So maybe this is not a bet I should take so hastily, but I think I'm still satisfied with my chances of winning. Either way, the podcast wins, right? I mean,
yeah,
we get a nice Fables Brewing 5-0 or two of the members get cookies.
Well, you're not both getting cookies. That's crazy. All right, let me think about this. Let me think about how much time I have to play this week.
Well, this is an open offer. I don't think Damon's not going to retract it next week when he's going to decide that Bolas of Citadel is too powerful.
Well, if Dan is like, oh, I'm not going to ready to take the bet yet, and he shows up with a 5-0 Bolas of Citadel, I guess I might reconsider, but that's not going to happen, so.
All right. That was a pre-Horizons deck list. I haven't even updated it at all with Modern Horizons cards. Actually, that's not true. It had a Goblin Engineers, but I've learned more about the strength of cards like Astrolabe. So I think I can build a much better version of the deck and just hope that people stop playing Karn and that kind of thing. Karn, the great creator, is like a real pain, a thorn in the side.
Yeah, it's true. So you're going to play Arkham's Astrolabe in the deck?
Maybe.
That makes sense.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, well, I think that's a good sort of rundown for now of decks we're thinking about. We'll, I think, have plenty to explore and plenty to report back on next week. Some of these old favorites in the new metagame. Any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I can't wait to hit up these old decks. These decks are all tons of fun.
Yeah. All right, so I think that'll do it then. Catch you guys later. And good luck on the queues.
All right, can't wait for my cookies.
Take it easy, gentlemen.
That'll do it for episode 19 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find all of the decks from today's show in the episode description of your preferred podcast player. If you like what you heard, have feedback for us, or just want to talk brews, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Email us, faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, and please consider leaving us an iTunes review. We depend on brewers like you to help us grow, improve the show, and bring you better content. So give us a follow, tell a friend, and we will see you next week.